Oh my God, this is freaking perfect. Okay, so welcome everybody. My name is Josh Wachtel, and this is the very first episode of the New Rural Advocate. This is a podcast and will be on our website as well. And this is a place where we get to talk about new ruralism, what it means to live out in rural areas in the modern era. What are people living out here for? What are we trying to do? What is the value of that? What is the meaning? What is the purpose? Why? Why bother? And what's it look like? And how can we do it better? All those good things. And I am here on Sawyer Farm with my friend Lincoln Fishman, who is farming here with his wife for the last... Yeah, there's Lincoln. For the last 5 or 6 years. And we are out on the porch at 8 p.m. The crickets are chirping. We just turned out the lights. We're just sitting on the porch of his farm stand looking out. And the forest is silhouetted. It's just perfect.
Just chatting as if we weren't being recorded.
That's right.
Just a regular talk.
So, well, let's just break right into it. So, Well, let me just say this, Lincoln. I mean, I've been thinking about this podcast for a very long time.
Right.
You've been hearing about it for well over a year and a half, I think, is when I told you about it first. And I was thinking about it for a while before that. But I just think there's some really cool things going on here in Western Massachusetts. I think it's probably happening all across the country where people are coming to the land and trying to develop a new relationship with nature, with the land, with their neighbors, with other people. And so you've been really enthusiastic about the project and are willing to be a guinea pig for this very first episode.
So yeah, I'm excited to be a guinea pig. I love guinea pigs.
Thanks for joining me.
They're delicious.
So... I want to know why you came out here. Why did you move out here? You had a good life, I'm sure.
I did. So the answer to that question depends if you want me to go in depth or not. You want the short or the long?
I don't know. Go. Give me the short version first.
Let me give you the short version. The short version is that I was living in New York with Hillary, who's my partner. Now,
in the city,
in New York City, and for a variety of reasons, which I would include in the long version, it was just time to like get out. We didn't know what was going on next. My parents own a piece of land in central Pennsylvania. There was nothing on it. There was kind of like a falling down cabin. But we thought I had been spending my summers out there. So I was teaching high school, and I had been spending, you know, I had summers off, and I spent my summers there just, like, messing around. It was just great. I just camped out. Friends would come out, and I would just, like, make trails and have fires and hang out with friends and just really, I mean, it was just sort of camping in a spot. And yeah, the longer that went on, the more I was like, man, I wish this was my life and teaching was my summer. That like I wanted the proportions to be reversed. Anyway, when Hill and I both happened to be sort of ready to quit our jobs at the same time, and I was like, well, we might as well go there because we could just go there and not need any money at all, basically, and just see kind of what happens and try to grow food and sort of.
Had you been thinking about farming for a long time?
No, I'm going to give you the long version, goddammit, because this is silly. Okay, so I grew up in central New Jersey in a small town. But we had, my mom was really into the idea of having animals. And we were like the only people in, I mean, we were right in the middle of this. I mean, it was a small town, but we were right in the middle of it. And... we built a chicken coop and had like a bunch of laying hens and we had some goats and they had a decent sized garden. I mean, it didn't feed us at all, but it was like enough to stick in my mind, and harvesting stuff and eating what you grew was not completely alien to me. And I also had, I spent much of my childhood in the woods. And it was tiny. Going back now, you're like, oh my God, this is nothing. I don't know. There was maybe, it went sort of deep, but like the part that I explored was probably 30 acres or something. There was a creek and a cornfield and whatever. And friends and I would like draw maps and we would play soldier games and war games crawling around in the creek bed and through like the rose bushes and whatever, like the wild roses. So it is not completely alien to me, but it was also Central Jersey. So it was like, you know, there was a strip mall like 2.5 miles away. And now fast forwarding and all my interests were sort of in like education, just urban education, inequality, that kind of thing.
Hmm.
And so after school, I did one of these, like, it wasn't Teach for America. It was one of Teach for America type program.
Mm-hmm.
Where they pay for your master's, but you start teaching right away. Okay. So I was teaching high school science, mostly biology, but also some of everything else because you just have to tag in. I mean, it's like the system's taxed. You just have to do what needs to be done. But I also got to teach this senior elective called Science and Society, which was basically like issues in science that are in the news. Like, what's the science behind these? Like, we did abortion.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what's the science behind that? And then we were doing global warming. What's the science behind that? And at some point I read in the paper, so a lot of my students were Latino students. That was the neighborhood that my school was in. I read in the New York Times that 30-something percent of Latino high schoolers were going to eventually get diabetes in their lifetime.
Wow.
And I was like, wow, I need to at least teach like what diabetes is and how you cannot get it. Because obviously, on average anyway, this is like a significant problem. That's actually where it's, I mean, in a way, this is where farming started.
Hmm.
So I started to
wait. So you're saying you're working with these kids in the city and you realize something's wrong in the diet and you wanted to do something about it.
Yeah. And I didn't even think about it quite in that way yet. I was more like, I was much more, I think, in a mainstream type of thinking about this, which is like diabetes. It's a disease. There are ways to avoid it, as you know, like in the same way that I would have talked about not smoking so you don't get lung cancer, or you know what I mean? Like, yeah. It was just a disease to me. It wasn't tied into all these things.
Right.
Does that make sense?
Well, are you saying you were motivated to do something more than just teach?
Well, I was motivated to teach about diabetes and so that they would understand. I mean, I didn't know what it was. I didn't know like what really caused it or like what the problem was. And it was like, I don't know. I knew it had something to do with sugar, mm-hmm. but that was kind of it.
Yeah.
And so we started talking about like what the disease is and how you get it. I'm talking about type 2 diabetes, obviously, yeah. Not the kind you're born with. And so we started talking about like sugars, and I was like, well, geez, why is sugar bad? And we started talking about that. And then it was like, well, why is there so much sugar around? And like, what choices should you make? You know, and that's like, geez, it's hard to make those choices actually, because everything, you know, from their perspective,
yeah.
You know, there's basically, you know, if you're like, well, you can't eat sugar, they're like, okay, like, name me one thing I can eat, like broccoli. And you're like, yeah, I mean, broccoli, but there's other stuff. So I had to really start thinking about it. Like, yeah, what is it? And what is sugar? What's processed sugar? What's the difference between
high fructose corn syrup?
Right. So we started to really get into that. Yeah, we really like pursued that in depth, and it started to move in a different direction, which is kind of like the food pyramid. So when we talked about the food pyramid, I'm talking about like the USDA, you mm-hmm. know, the one that they, like the one that they
published. The latest and greatest.
The latest and greatest. I don't even think it's a pyramid anymore, man. I think it's like a...
It's groups. It's like
what's
puddles
the shape
or something.
Now? Yeah, puddles. The food puddles. Yeah. Yeah, so we looked at the food puddles, which at that time was shaped like a triangle, but they called it a pyramid.
What do they know?
Yeah, it's like, you know, a pyramid's 3D, right? So, yeah, as we were looking at that, we started talking about, like, I got into everything else. Like, what is a starch, and what's a simple starch, and what's a complex starch?
Well, now you've gone beyond me.
Yeah, well, carbs, think about it, carbs. So white rice is simple and brown rice is complex.
Ah.
Or like white bread is simple. I mean, I'm also simplifying right now,
yeah,
but
yeah.
Like
okay,
whole grain versus, you know, a sort of processed, whitened thing.
Were they interested in what you were talking about?
I hope so.
You were interested,
yes.
I can tell.
They were interested because I was interested because it was like class. I think it was cool because... You know, in an ideal world, now we're getting into education, but like in an ideal world, and now I'm talking to a teacher, so it's also silly for me to like tell you because you know more than me, but you know, if you're learning with your students, I mean, this is the point of your school. If you're learning with your students,
yeah,
they feel that excitement, and it's not directed by you. It's directed by like, it becomes a thing. It takes on a life of its own, right? Like the group is searching for knowledge.
Definitely.
And yeah, so we searched beyond the pyramid and we got into different classifications. I wish I could remember what they were. There's a few very different ways of thinking about food, and essentially I arrived at like the idea that there's like real food that gets made, that like gets grown and just is food because it's food. Because it, like, grows out of the earth, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And then there's, like, the other 95% of what is sold in stores, which is, like, not food. It's scientific food.
So
it's
there's
like
the aha.
It was a real aha for me. I was like, oh. And, you know, it was funny. At the same time, my mom was on the,
some diet.
Yeah, but go. I mean, it's just Weight Watchers.
Okay.
And she was like, do you know that fruits and vegetables are 0 points? And I was like, yeah, that makes sense because they're just fruits and vegetables. Like the things that are points, like you just shouldn't even be eating it. Or like they're not food. So
meaning
like,
the 0 points means you can eat all the fruits and vegetables you want all
right,
day long.
Which is so silly because it's like, of course you can. Of course. That's like what you should eat all day long, right? But I think the revelation she was kind of having was the same one that I was at that time.
So was it that direct? Like you're like, okay, I want to make food. Or we're...
No, just, so nah. it keeps going. Right. I'm going to tell you part two.
Part B.
Ready?
Here we go. Chapter two.
Chapter two. My next unit was supposed to be global warming. After this, like, nutrition unit that was accidental anyway. Like, the whole diabetes nutrition thing was like...
What
ugh.
Do these things have to do with science in the modern world?
Exactly. Nothing, basically. So I was, like, trying to wrap it up so I could get to global warming. And then at that point, I read... Omnivore's Dilemma.
Oh, yeah.
Which I think for a lot of people was
Michael
kind of
Pollan.
A thing, right? Michael Pollan. And my students, honestly, would not have been able to, like, read that book. Their reading level was not there. So I sort of was rewriting it, like, chapter by chapter. Like, actually just putting it in simpler terms. And that gets into a whole nother conversation about literacy in the New York City public school system. And he just made that, you know, connection where it's like, oh, not only is it bad for human health, it's really bad for the world and is completely connected to global warming and just environmental degradation in general. Right? I mean, it's like...
Yeah, I hear you. Because the farming system, mass factory farming system is rotten to the core.
From
top to bottom.
And I mean, look, it's complicated because it also feeds so many people. I feel like this is a conversation that we were having the other day too.
Yeah.
Where like there's many sides to this story.
Yeah.
And I'm not ready to like throw the whole thing away. But it's important to recognize
its limitations.
Its limitations. And it's definite contribution to global warming. This is, this is a fossil fuel based system from like we feed the plants fossil fuel.
Yeah.
And we require fossil fuel to do all the field work. And then mostly we require fossil fuel to move it from A to B.
Yeah.
The whole system is just based on this idea of like free and cheap energy. Sorry. You asked me. Keep going.
So what I'm hearing is this course, basically you're using your course to talk yourself out of teaching and into something else.
Right. So it gets into global... Okay, and then my last unit in the class I was teaching was just called Armageddon. I worked at a great school, and I give tremendous credit to my principal because he was just like, yeah, sure, that sounds great. Yeah, that's cool. The kids should know about that.
This is a public school?
Yeah.
Public.
But it was one of the small... It was a small school, but yeah, it was a public school.
Yeah.
And my principal was just amazing and gave me free rein, which, like, looking back on it, I was 24, maybe. I mean, I was not a lot older than my kids.
Well, that's a nice arrangement because a lot of people teaching these days don't get anywhere near that kind of freedom.
Yeah, it's incredible. I don't know that it would actually exist anymore in New York given the testing regimen. You know, I don't know that they would allow
fun
room for,
learning
for interesting stuff like this, you know, that's like not testable. But, So I was like, all right, we're going to keep the kind of the food thing and move right into Armageddon. And we started talking about other stuff related to food, which is like, who picked that head of lettuce?
Oh,
you know, who slaughtered that cow? You know,
social justice.
Yeah. And, to me, that's a huge part of what we should be talking about when we talk about the larger food system. Cause I think the human lives, especially in meat, but also really in vegetables. I mean, there's no point comparing it's just that part of it is really dirty. If you think about it, we're just treating people horribly. And now many years later, also just that we're in the middle of this whole immigration what do we call it even? But like we rely on a whole class of people who are totally disenfranchised to deliver food to our table. And so we had been learning about that and talking about that in class. And okay, so my school was on the Lower East Side of Manhattan. This is a neighborhood that probably has more choices of what to eat for lunch than any neighborhood, I don't know, in America. It's like historically Jewish. There's that going on. You're at the border of Chinatown, so there's like lots of Chinese restaurants and also other Asian groups that are like represented at the border, particularly of Chinatown there. There's lots of, if you go to the east there, there's tons of, Latino restaurants also like from a bunch of different countries. And then there's more upscale places that are serving whatever you want to call it, like everything you can think of that are inspired by. Anyway, point being, if you have 50 minutes for lunch,
you could study do a practical study of food there.
Right.
Food around the world.
The choices are literally pretty much endless. I mean, you could just, yeah. But I went outside one day after talking about this, like, who picks your food? And I thought, well, I have, you know, probably 50 choices within two blocks. And none of them are ethical. Mm. Not one. Hmm. Every one of any given option is, like, tainted in some way. Whether it's who harvested it, or the practices, what chemicals were sprayed on it, or the erosion that's going on in the land, or the life of the animal that you're about to eat, or I remember where I was standing. I was standing in the street, looking around and being like, there's just no, I can't make a good choice right now. The world that I'm living in right now has constrained me so much, while pretending at the opposite of constraint, right?
It's the like the largest this, city in the U.S., the most, right. More diversity than anybody, yes. Could imagine ever, yes. In world history or something.
Yes.
And
yes. And what's the one thing I can't choose? I can't choose to eat ethically.
Yeah.
That.
The omnivore's dilemma.
That was crazy to me. And I just never thought about it that way.
All right. So what do you do?
So you start thinking about, like, what would an ethical meal look like? And I should say, by the way, and this is like a test, this is what's cool, and this is what's cool about what you're doing, and what's cool about what a lot of people who live in cities are doing too, is like there's so much more awareness around this
from 15 years ago or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah. From this was, yeah, 2005 probably, or 2000, mm-hmm. Earlier. I am not good with dates. That's probably not true anymore. There probably are a dozen places around there where if you wanted to go get farm sourced food that's, yeah. Like within, you know, some reasonable range of that restaurant.
Yeah.
But at that point, that was not true, except for one cheese shop in the Essex Market, which I wish I wasn't blanking on the woman's name. But she was certainly the first in that neighborhood, to my knowledge. Yeah, so it was like, well, what would it even be like? And then it became kind of just this idea in the back of my head. What would it mean to take control of your food, to try to do the right thing, to put the right thing in your body in terms of health, but really for me, much more importantly, in terms of your impact on the world? What does it mean? How would that even, was it possible? I think, yeah. I didn't even know if it was possible. Like, could you?
Yeah.
And it's,
well,
yep.
No, well, let's fast forward, because, I mean, I was on your farm tour, what is it, like a month ago, and if anybody looks on the website, the banner right now is you on your horses, or next to your horses. I think you're on your horses in that picture, but there's a few pictures, talking to a group of people about this way of farming, and you're farming, you're feeding, I don't know how many pounds of food you guys, or how many tons of food you guys are growing here with two horses. And a lot of hard work,
mm-hmm.
And land that you've improved yourself with the help of the horses, mm-hmm. And a lot of hard work. So, you know, what does this mean? What's it look? Tell us a little bit about the farm, you know, what that looks like, and how, you know, how do you, you know, it sounds, you're fulfilling that dream that, or you're working towards a goal. This is what it looks like right now.
Right.
Fill us in.
Okay, cool. So, yeah, I guess the broadest picture, we bought 45 acres in Western Mass in Worthington, town of 1,200 people. It was a dairy farm for many years, but hadn't been for probably 15 years before we bought it.
And that's pretty true of so many of these farms. All the dairy,
absolutely,
at least the smaller
totally.
Dairies in the hill towns. I guess there's some more dairies in the wider Western Mass region, but definitely in my town, your town, it seems like most of them have folded up or gotten real small.
Yeah, I mean, historically, this was a huge, small-scale dairy area. And at this point, I think, we're down to, in Worthington, there's one left. In Worthington, there's none left. I don't even think the last one is actually providing milk to the company anymore, I think.
Yeah.
And then Covington has two. So, yeah, I mean, we're, you know, flip side being a couple real tiny new ones have opened up.
Yeah. Well, that's what,
and that's,
there's
what new
smaller
is, I mean,
farms growing up, like
right.
yours, like
right.
our friends, the cheesemakers, and yeah,
right.
I mean, there's really cool experiments, which is one of the reasons why I want to talk to you, and I'll talk to others.
Right. But this land, I mean, it's interesting. I mean, so the property that we bought is kind of worthless in terms of agriculture. If you think about the scale that agriculture has become. And the truth is, there's better land available even in Worthington. But this is totally farmable land. And at the time when there was a lot of small dairies, this was not considered a crazy place to, you know, make milk, to, like, feed cows and make milk. It was like, I don't know, it was just a place. It was just a, you know, and there was...
A beautiful place.
Yeah, it's lovely.
It's like a rolling hill here into the stream, I think I heard very loudly as I was driving.
Yeah, there's kind of two creeks that go
two
on
creeks.
Either side of the house and the barn, real small creeks. And then all the half of our land is on that side of the creek. There's, you know, 20-something acres that way. And then on...
Towards the south.
This side is... is like a big hill that's all open, and there's about...
Which is basically a south-facing hill.
Right, yeah, southwest face.
Mm-hmm.
And that's probably about 15 acres, and 5 of it is vegetables, and 10 of it is pasture and hay. So, you know, it's on a slope just to begin with. I mean, that's basically... No one farms on that anymore. Because you can farm more easily on other flat land. But, you know, I remind myself when I'm sort of frustrated about whatever is not ideal about this property that, like, people made their living farming this property, you know, for probably 150 years. It doesn't not produce stuff. It's great soil. And what it requires is, like, some extra work to figure out how to accommodate the things about it that are less than ideal.
Yeah, so...
Sorry, I didn't answer your question.
No, that's okay. Talk about, you know, how you're farming the land.
Okay.
What you're producing. How does that address, you know, your concerns about food in general?
Okay. So we were like, yeah, so 45 acres, half is in woods, half is in pasture, and vegetables. 5 acres of vegetables, let's say 4 acres of vegetables maybe. And then, I don't know, 10, 12, 15 in pasture. I don't really know. And I would say vegetables is our focus. When we started, we were doing a whole diet CSA. And that is, so CSA, right, Community Supported Agriculture, you sign up ahead of time, and every week you get a box that has whatever's available in it. Typically, CSAs are just vegetables, but we were doing something called a whole diet CSA. It was kind of like a concept Hill and I generated when we were in Pennsylvania. But then we looked around and we found one farm that was doing it in Essex, New York, and we went and worked there. And it's called Essex Farm. So your box, which wasn't really a box, you could take whatever you wanted, as much as you wanted, and whatever you wanted, and that was inspired by Essex Farm. It's vegetables, meat, dairy, so it was milk and like ricotta or farmer's cheeses type things, and yogurt. Hill did all that. She also baked bread using local wheat. And we made maple syrup. I mean, it was kind of a huge, broad offering of stuff.
It was super incredible. And we didn't really learn about it till kind of the last few months that you were doing it. But, and I can see why that was hard to do. On the other hand, I felt coming here, because it was like a certain day, afternoon, you could pick up. It was a super social scene.
Yes.
It was really fun to be here and meet people.
Yeah, that part we loved about it.
And I'm sure in a way that you ingratiated yourselves with the community in a way that, you know, even though maybe it wasn't profitable or whatever right off the bat, people got to know you and love you because you really invited them literally into your home.
Yes, it was very personal. I mean, when we started, we were distributing out of the basement. And then later we were just distributing out of like the bedroom in the back of the in the back of the house.
It was awesome.
Yeah. It was really cool. It was really cool. But I would say, so it was from our perspective, it was hard in ways that I can talk about. I thought that the bigger problem was it actually excluded a lot of people.
Uh-huh.
Like
you couldn't come and buy a carrot.
Right. And in a weird way, it was like, well, if you're already in the club, we're for you. And if you're not, if you're just kind of starting to know about eating locally and starting to care about that stuff, we don't have anything to offer you because you're either in or you're out. It was a lot of money. I mean, it was really cheap for what it was, but it was $5,500 a year for a couple.
Right.
If you're the kind of couple who's just going to eat this, it was the craziest deal in the world because, like, you, some of the things you literally couldn't get. I mean, we were making butter.
There was meat, too, right?
And yeah, there was meat.
Yeah.
And then, but, like, you know, I think of the butter all the time because, like, you can't get butter from 4 grass-fed cows, which is what we were offering. I mean, it's not a product you can, it's just not even available. Like, it doesn't exist on the market. You can't find it. Yeah, and so for that handful of people, it was an amazing deal. But if you're more normal and you're like shifting to this kind of diet, or if you like local farming, you like local products, but you have like kids who won't eat the things that blah, or you're an older couple and you have been married for 40 years and you've been cooking the same thing you've been making lasagna every Tuesday night for 40 years. And we just don't have some of the things that you want to put in there. You know, it just doesn't work for you. And so it actually felt like we were excluding a lot of folks who lived around here who would be interested in this or that, but not the entire package. So that was one of the reasons we started to break it up. Like, you could get a vegetable share, or an egg share, or a meat share, or whatever, or you could get more shares. It got deeply complicated. And then the main shift for us really was having Leo, who's 3.5 now. And when he was born, or really when Hill was pregnant towards the end, we were just like, man, we don't have room in our life to do this. And I think we sort of felt like we should have room to do this because historically that is what everyone did for themselves, at least. Like, you would run your own whole diet CSA because you had to, you know what I mean? You had to grow everything you ate, basically. So you, if you lived around here anyway, mm-hmm. So you like did. So I don't know, somehow in our mind was like, well, it should be possible and it shouldn't be that hard. But either it was that hard because it is that hard, or it was that hard because our modern, you know, conception of what hard work looks like you know, you can never erase the idea that Hill and I already know, or that all of us already know, which is like you can also go to Big Y and just get food like everybody else, and it doesn't like take any work except like the work that you have to do. But food is so cheap that you can kind of eat whatever you want.
Yeah,
at least that Big Y has to offer for not that much work. That's not really what people spend their money on anymore, right? We spend our money on housing, car insurance, phone bills, things that, you know, homesteaders here 50 or 100 years ago, just bills that they just didn't have to pay. So I've lost that train of thought now.
Yeah.
Help me.
Well,
oh, so we switched. Should I say that?
Yeah, well, I know you did switch. Yeah, well, yeah, I mean, I think what I've seen is it's been experimentation. You know, each year you kind of figure out how we're going to do it this year.
Yes,
you
know, because, totally.
Because it's your...
And
it's,
much,
it's not a thing. It's not a thing, or it's yes. barely a thing to take 35, 45 acres, half of it woods on a hill with, like, you know, out in the boonies. You know, you're not producing enough food to... You're not doing the market model.
Right.
So you're creating your own market.
Right.
You know? And so, yeah, you try
and
different
me,
things.
And I feel like that's, like, sort of the heart of what we are talking about when with kind of creating community and new ruralism is part of why we haven't done markets, which I have nothing.
Well, I don't mean farmers markets. I mean you're literally creating a market in the sort of abstract sense of
right
like,
but the market's here. I guess that's the thing that's cool.
You have your farmers market on your land now,
right? But I mean, the market is the community.
The market is the community, exactly, and that's what I think a lot of small farms are doing so brilliantly. I mean, and it's amazing because we're very sparsely populated, so
right.
that's like a challenge. You really have to win over
and
people
like, almost,
who are
like
here.
Everybody, right?
Yeah,
right.
And now that doesn't make a lot of room for the next guy who wants to come in and buy a 35-acre farm. Unless
well,
he's,
it's
you
tricky.
Know, it's tricky.
Unless we can convert more people to wanting to eat this way. Because the flip side
yeah.
of that is like this farm. If we had probably 30 to 50 families who actually ate from this farm, that would be our limit. I mean, we can't do more than that. Which means that even in a tiny town of 1,200 people, you could have a couple dozen of these farms. It shouldn't be competitive. It shouldn't be competitive at all. It should be, I mean, in my ideal world, you know, what we're doing
well, that's what this
could expand
is about.
Out. There could be so many farmers like us, even in this little
yeah.
town of 1,200 people,
yeah.
if people were going to eat this food.
Healthy food.
Healthy food. Food that's
local
grown
food.
Here.
Yeah.
yeah. But, you know, we're not at all there yet. And at the moment, like, part of the reason we don't do vegetables during the summer. We just do vegetables in fall, winter, and spring. We do storage crops.
Which is
crops.
Unique.
Right.
I think.
There are a few places that do this. I mean, I'm sure there's many places that do this. I only know of a few. It makes a lot of sense in New England because it's almost always winter here. And, you know, crops only grow for like a minute. You know, tomato season is like 3 weeks long.
Yeah.
So, you know,
and
there's
a lot
to be said for winter vegetables.
And for but, here, a lot of those crops, the summer crops, they're going to do a lot better down in the valley, in the Connecticut River Valley.
Right.
You know.
Yeah, their season is probably 2 weeks longer on either side, and maybe more. But yeah, and I mean, part of the reason we're not doing summer—that's one reason. But I mean, this year at least, where we could have done summer crops, the big reason we're not doing it is because there's a trip who's farming in town, who's awesome and does a great job, does summer vegetables.
Yeah.
And it's crazy, again, that in a town with 1,200 people, one small farm stand would be able to compete with another in a way that would really drag one down.
Right.
But, like, Tripp does a great job. I want to support him. I'm happy to not do the work of summer vegetables. And until, like, interest and the market grows, I do think if we did summer vegetables that we would end up kind of going head-to-head with him.
Mm-hmm.
It would be folks who shopped at his place versus folks who shopped at our place. And I just have no interest in that, and I think instead we're going to pass business back and forth, which is awesome, and we're like friends, and it's great. It's a little bit disappointing on the level of, like, it shows you kind of how undeveloped the market and the sensibility is around eating local food.
Well,
that, like, these two farms have to split the money from.
Yeah.
From 1,200 people. If all those people were actually shopping at our farms,
yeah,
we could have 10 more farms in Worthington and still all make more money than we do now.
Well, I'm just going to admit, I know it's expensive. It's expensive to buy local. It's expensive to buy really healthy food. I kind of close my eyes and have deferred to my wife, Kim, because she insists on buying healthy food, and I realize that it's really good to buy healthy food. But it's hard to, like, slap down that money when you can go into the supermarket and get so much more food.
Right.
So it really is a choice. And but if people make that choice, it literally is making a difference for how somebody like you is able to live and work.
Yeah.
And work the land.
Yeah. And I'm not exempting myself either. I mean, we buy things at Walmart. We buy things on Amazon. I'm totally not a purist. I love Snickers. There's, like, a whole zone and world of
diabetes.
Things. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So I'm like, not... I don't want to be holier than thou about any of it. I mean, you know, I don't know if we weren't doing this ourselves. You know, our food is real cheap for us because it's here and we grew it, so we eat it. But if we weren't, I don't know. I mean, it is. I mean, you really have to commit a greater percentage of what you earn, which, yeah, I mean, everybody has to think about money. Mm-hmm. And where you want to put it. And yeah. I think increasingly, like, Walmart has, like, organic options for things that are really cheap.
And I'm glad they do.
Yeah.
Whatever that means.
I guess it's better than not organic.
Yeah. Presumably, although we'll have to get somebody on to talk about that.
Like, new... I mean, to me, like, the idea of new ruralism is, like, you are willing to spend a little bit more. I have to say, too, I mean, some of it is a fallacy. Like, there are things that are more expensive. I mean, you know, our chicken is probably $7 a pound on average if you, you know, from different cuts. Maybe more like $6. But anyway, you know, that's a no-brainer. You can go to Big Y and get chicken for, I don't know.
I've had $2 or $3 whole chicken for like $10 or something.
Right. And our whole chickens, which are big, but still, I mean, are like 20, in the low 20s or, you know, for like... We charge, it's $5.50 for a whole bird.
Well, I mean,
per pound for a whole bird.
Look, you can't get around economics if you're going to talk about new ruralism. It's like one of the fundamental facts.
Totally. But I just want to say, like, some of the other things, like, I just feel like there are actually some real deals here. Like, so all of our root vegetables are $2 a pound. Which is the same as shitty organic, like, you know, industrial organic.
Right.
vegetables from wherever.
And you can't advertise super beyond, way beyond organic.
Right. Or like, I just think it's in people's heads, anything you buy in our store is going to be like more expensive.
And it might not be.
And it might really not be. So I wish people would kind of have a little more of an eye to that. But again, I understand. Your assumption, you know, we can't pay attention to every single item. So it's like, oh, well, beets are cheaper here, but their daikon is more expensive. There really are some things that are like deals. I would put the vegetables out there for sure, but like other local products, interesting. Like we have the cheapest maple syrup. Like you go to the supermarket, you're going to pay tons more. And the reason it's cheap is because it is produced here, and I buy it from our neighbor and sell it in the store. And it's like, you won't find those prices anywhere else, you know, and certainly not in like a big box store type place. So, you know, only to say like there's a range, and if you want to eat cheaply, and then there's other things we sell. I mean, we sell like whole corn for making tortillas.
And those are amazing.
They're really good. I'm also a fan. But I mean, that's a super cheap way to eat. It's work. There's work in there. But, well, I mean, you can... It wasn't that much work. It's going to beat anything you can find per calorie. You know, if you're looking at, like, calories per dollar.
Yeah.
I mean, it's crazy. And it's grown with, like, real horse shit. And it's harvested by hand. I mean, it's not like a...
This is...
It just doesn't exist. You know what I mean? Like, you can't even get it anywhere.
No, you can't. Because this is the corn with the lime treatment. Is that what it is? Lime?
Right.
And basically, it's ready to go. I think we threw it in a Cuisinart with water or something?
You boil it first.
Boil it.
Then you let it sit overnight, and then you throw it in the Cuisinart, or you get, like, a little hand grinder.
And those tortillas were amazing.
Yeah, they're out of control. And, like... The amount of food that's in one of those 5-pound bags, it's the basis of a meal for a family for like two solid meals.
Yeah.
So that's five. You just spent $5, and all you need to put in that is like an egg and salsa.
Yeah. So you've been super creative, and you keep being creative. I saw you guys making a big batch of salsa. I don't know if you ever sold that last year or not.
We can't because of...
All that.
Yep.
All right. Well, that's something we got to work on.
I know.
Those shared facilities. I think they exist.
Greenfield has one.
All right. Well, anyway, look, we've been on a while. Let me ask you this question, and then we'll wrap it up for this evening. What have you learned? What from all this, you know, starting with... this sort of imperative, like, I have to do something about the food system.
right. That's
a really
good question.
And here you freaking are out here doing it for, you know, year after year. Successful enough. I know we're heading into another season. The growing season's over. You're going to be selling all winter. But what have you learned about farming, about your community, about what's possible?
Man, I think I've learned a lesson, and maybe this is, I don't know if this is parenthood or if it's just like maturity, but, you know, I am so much less idealistic than I used to be. I think one thing that I learned is that, like, you can't be on a ideological rampage and have a nice family life all the time. And you just, like, I'm just always trying to find that balance. You know what I mean?
I don't know. You got to parse that a little, because a lot of people would come out here and look at what you're doing and go on your farm tour and say, how ideological, much more ideological could you be? So you got to explain that to me.
Yeah. So... I mean, first of all, we do less stuff than we used to do. You know, we don't milk anymore for starters. Hill's not baking bread anymore. So we've way cut back on kind of this, like, grand vision that we had. But I agree with you. I mean, in another way, if I step back and I sort of look at it, it's like, oh, they're farming with horses, which we haven't talked about.
No.
And, yeah, they're growing all this food, and they're selling it very locally, and... but I do think, like, in my own head, it's been a process of, like, cutting down, cutting back,
yeah,
peeling things away, having to be, like, having the real world kind of, like, cut into your grand view.
Yeah.
Well. And being like, yeah, you know, I just want to. It's so all-consuming, you know? It's so seasonally based, and, like, when work hits, it's so intense, and trying to be like, how do you not let it consume your life? How do you find that balance? And also thinking so much more about the money part of it, and trying to make that reasonable. You know, the last 3 years I would do construction in winter and spring.
Yeah.
And you know, I could make the money that we make on farming working 3 days a week at construction at $25 an hour.
Yeah.
Well, you know, so I'm asking myself all the time, like, what does matter? And
yeah.
I would be a better community member. I would be a better friend. I would be a better dad. And I would be a better partner. And that was in reverse order of what matters, by the way. you know, if I wasn't doing this. So you have to wonder. So, like, that just, I'm just saying that whole set of issues has really weighed on me heavily in the last bunch of years.
Yeah.
Like, what is it worth to fight the fight? And how much does the fight matter? And how much does it give to you? And how much of that fight can you do and still feel like you're in it and it's gratifying? But that you're not just, like, losing yourself to it and sacrificing the rest of your life to it. And I do not know the answer to that yet, but I have been trying to cut back. But, like, what I know, and I think what's been nice for me to know over the last couple of years is, like, I kind of had a crisis thing after Leo was born. He was probably, man, I can't remember. Hillary would know. But it was like, he was probably a little under a year. And I was just like, what am I doing? This is crazy. I'm, like, busy all the time with this stupid shit that doesn't matter. And I guess what I have learned in the 3 years since then is I don't want to do anything else. I know for myself that, like, I don't want to do anything else. I don't know what that means. Like, it kind of leaves me nowhere. But, again, the horses, which we didn't talk about, but, like, when I'm out in the field, which is beautiful up there, and working with the horses, which are these, like, two living things, and they provide the power and the fertility for all the vegetables. And you have this weird, crazy relationship with them that's, like, kind of indescribable. Yeah, I fantasize about being on vacation with my family. You know, just leaving it all. But I don't fantasize about any other line of work. It's very gratifying work. It's as close. If I could be a hunter-gatherer, I guess I would do that. but it's as close to history and real human experience as I think I can get in this lifetime. It feels essential, as in the essence. Not that it's essential that I do it, but it's the essence of human existence. So I get to be close to that during the day. And it's also very silly because, like, it's so silly what people need to be alive. It's just so goofy. I mean, the whole thing is, like, just crazy. I mean, yeah, evolution and, like, having to eat and reproduction. I mean, it's all... You know what I mean? It's all so ephemeral and bizarre. But given that that's true, it is how I want to spend my time. And then if I can add on top of that, that the food that we grow feeds people that we know, that it connects us to people in that way, and that they're eating the food that's the product of, you know, literally the horse's sweat and my sweat, and that I've put everything into, so much into, that feels really gratifying. I don't know what else could I do. I don't know if I can do anything else now. You know?
Yeah. Well, thanks for sharing that. That's very personal, and I found it very meaningful. So I hope if you've listened through, you've enjoyed this first podcast of New Rural Advocate with Lincoln Fishman, and I'm Josh Wachtel. Until next time.
Can I say one thing to you, which you can cut out if you want? Yeah. I just think that the work you're doing with the site and with these podcasts and just trying to promote this idea generally is super important in trying to help people think about, you know, creating the world that they want to be in. And it just provides like a frame for people to think about what they do, where they shop, who they talk to. Yeah, I think that more than anything, that kind of work is important. Because it's kind of encouraging people to take the fantasy world and make it real. That it's not, it doesn't have to be an abstract concept that they, you know, I wish the world was like X, Y, or Z. But it's like, oh, people are doing X, Y, and Z, and I can, like, be part of this thing. And I can do whatever, you know, whatever it is. Whether it's to be a farmer, to be a gardener, to be a patron of one of those places. To be involved in their, like, actual geographical community.
Mm.
In whatever way feels good. It's happening.
All right, people, man. Do it. I can't cut that. That's You're music great. To my ears. That's New Ruralism, man. All right.
New Ruralism.
We're going to do it. See ya.